Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome David Bray back to the broadcast. David's the Executive Director of the People-Centered Internet, an internet coalition that provides support and expertise for community-focused projects that measurably improve people's lives using the internet. As Executive Director, David works closely with the co-founders Vint Cerf, the father of the internet, and Mei Lin Feng, the mother of customer relationship management, to prioritize and pursue opportunities. Prior to joining PCI, David served as the Chief Information Officer for the Federal Communications Commission. While at the FCC, David led the transformation of their legacy systems, including the rollout of cloud-based IT that achieved results in half the time at one-sixth the cost. David began working for the U.S. government at the age of 15. David has received numerous awards for his work, including being named one of the top 24 Americans who are changing the world under 40 by Business Insider. David has lectured at Harvard University, at MIT, at the University of Oxford, as well as at Singularity University. David was named a Marshall Memorial Fellow for 2017 and 2018. David earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Computer Science and Biology from Emory University, a Master's of Science degree in Public Health from Emory University School of Medicine, and a PhD from Emory University's Goizueta Business School. I recently caught up with David at the Google offices in Washington, D.C., and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 3, Project and Portfolio Management, as David described how he applies the Rule of 3 to prioritize the efforts of PCI, and Principle 5, External Partnerships, as David shared the ways in which he brings together positive change agents to apply new perspectives to difficult challenges. We also discussed the advantages of having grown his career in the government, his work as a Marshall Fellow, and the technology trends that worry and excite him, among other topics. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. TopTal helps organizations achieve the world-class skill, execution speed, and agility they need to win in an environment of increasing innovation and competition, especially in the realm of talent. Blockchain is a topic of increasing relevance to companies, and chief information officers need to develop a talent pipeline to help implement a blockchain strategy. I recently caught up with TopTal's CEO, Tasso Duval, who offered his top five thoughts on obtaining blockchain talent.
First, when hiring blockchain talent, don't focus too much on specific experience, especially since the tools of the trade are changing rapidly. Instead, hire people with a strong baseline knowledge of development and who have experience with cryptography or distributed systems. Second, look for developers who are enthusiastic about the technology. That enthusiasm will provide motivation for them to stay up to date on best practices and innovations in technology. Third, focus on quality of previous development work and attention to detail. Faulty development work can cost a lot in the long term, especially with blockchain implementations. Fourth, ensure you're peer reviewing the talent that comes into the network or that comes into your organization through other experts so that you're ensuring their blockchain knowledge is up to speed with your expectations. And fifth, ensure that when you're providing a management framework for the developer to work within, it's one that considers blockchain at its core, ensuring that the developer is not only working with best software practices, but also best blockchain practices is very important.
David Bray, welcome back to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thanks for having me, Peter. Great to be here with you.
It's wonderful, as always, to be with you. I thought we would begin with the People-Centered Internet, an organization that you have now recently joined in recent months. Can you talk a bit about your role and also the mission of PCI?
Sure. So the People-Centered Internet is a coalition founded by Vint Cerf, one of the co-creators of the internet, as well as Mei Lin Feng, who we like to say is the mother of CRM, customer relationship management. And the two of them came together really with the vision of how can we help give demonstration projects, measurable projects that help improve people's lives using the internet? Because the idea is right now, if we're not careful, we may lose the hope and the enthusiasm that the internet had in the 1990s. Right now, actually, according to Pew, if you poll 20-somethings, the optimism levels they have with the internet are not as high as they used to be. They still say they can't live without it, but they don't necessarily see it as a source of hope and of freedom and of uplifting of people's lives as we saw it as the early 90s. And so the goal is if we can provide demonstration projects that measurably improve people's lives through the internet, these will actually serve as sort of change agent case examples that then either local communities can sort of follow and adopt, policymakers might be able to use, even private corporations might be able to use as a model going forward, because it's all too easy to say this is not working or this is bad and do the negative stories. The positive stories is a little bit harder. However, we want to sort of be that force and provide that support and expertise. There's also the hope that we can actually espouse Doug Engelbart's original vision. So Doug Engelbart, inventor of the mouse, graphical user interface, did the mother of all demos about 50 years ago. In fact, December is going to be the anniversary of the mother of all demos that he did. And so he actually had the vision that technology was a way of bringing people together. And if we all think about our current lives right now, how many of us think the internet really is bringing people together versus polarizing and being divisive? And so that led to when I was actually with Vint, we were actually at a conference in Ireland, and we were both on the panel together. And right before the panel, one, I found out that my wife and I had been matched with adopting a newborn baby boy. So we were thrilled. And I told Vint. Vint initially said, can we tell everyone? I was like, let's wait to see if it gets finalized, but I appreciate your support. However, after the panel, two, we were both flying back. And actually, he was talking. He said, well, there's this thing called People's Internet. Would you be interested? And I leapt at the opportunity, the chance to work with Vint Cerf. Plus, you know, again, with a newborn baby boy, thinking about what does the internet look like in 2030 when he's going to be 13? Is it going to be a source of hope and inspiration? It really got me thinking about where can I play a role? Where can I make a difference? And it was a great opportunity.
It's interesting, even in the name, I think as people think about the internet, oftentimes they leap quickly to the technology behind it. And
right.
The people-centered aspect of what you're describing, the emphasis on the people, it's a very interesting theme to be the area of focus, as you point out.
It is, and it's something that I think resonates quite closely with me because early on, so in the 80s, I got an IBM PC that had a whopping 64 kilobytes of RAM for 16 colors. I was lucky enough to have 16 colors versus a monochrome screen, but it still had 5 1/4 floppy disk. And so in some respects, I grew up in this era of technology becoming more personalized initially the electronics era, and then eventually when the internet came along. I can remember the first time I actually used the internet, it was using Gopher and Archie protocols in 1993. So this is pre-World Wide Web and pre-Mozilla. Pre-Mozilla, but also pre-Mosaic as a web browser. And actually, one of the first things I did was actually look up the lyrics for some REM songs. But anyway, you know, what was the internet for, but not in search. However,
being a Georgian, especially.
Georgia band. Well, and it was actually, and the way I first got access to it in 1993 was not at the home. It was actually at a Department of Energy facility.
Oh.
So I was lucky enough to, they were modeling electron beams and things like that. And they also had a connection. That said, seeing how the internet has gone through its different stages. I mean, we had the dot-com hype, and then we had the dot-com crash, and then we had sort of the reconciliation, then we had Web 2.0. People talked about government 2.0, and it was the idea. I mean, if you remember, just one presidential cycle ago, back in 2008, most people did not have smartphones. Most people still had flip phones. And so that's a dramatic change that just occurred in the last 10 years. According to ITU, back in 2001, less than 2% of all households had one family member in the household had access to a mobile phone. And not smartphone, but mobile phone. Now it's 98% of all households in the world have at least one family member that has access to a mobile phone. So that's just a dramatic change in less than 2 decades. And so not only is the pace of technology accelerating, but the adoption curves are shrinking smaller and smaller. In some respects, that's good, because if something's out there that can help uplift people and actually bring communities together, that's great. But there's also the challenge of, like all things, technology is amoral. It's how we choose how to use it, decides whether it's good or bad. And Vint Cerf, again, one of the co-founders, I mean, we've been friends, I guess it's now 7 years now. He and I have had conversations about we often don't have the opportunity to have the programmer or the engineer think about the long second, third, and fourth order implications. In fact, it's not part of their training. I mean, their expertise is making sure that device does what it's supposed to do for that specific service and operate in that. It's another skill set, and partly it's a combination of visionary, partly it's a combination of artists, partly it's a combination of sociology and just awareness of human history that needs to also be taking a look of, well, if you roll that out, what are the unintended consequences that will occur? And actually, I was back in 2009, actually, when I hadn't actually leapt to formal government service. I was actually working in a think tank. Back in 2009, 2010, I ended up giving an unclassified presentation at the time that said, there is trouble ahead, specifically with the do-it-yourself movement. And I'm all for the do-it-yourself movement. It's very great. But it was what we were seeing back in 2009, 2010 was people could actually begin to build their own drones. And mostly these were hobbyists, and they were just seeing what they could do. However, you can imagine if you use this for not so good purposes, like you attach a firework to the drone or something like that, or you decide to swarm a building with it, or you decide to swarm an aircraft with it, there could be unintended consequences. And I put this as trouble ahead 5 to 6 or 7 years from now. And sure enough, we're now seeing where there's unclassified documents that put the U.S. military even at about 10 or so drones right now with conventional approaches are overwhelmed. And so we've got all these legacy investments that have been designed to keep us secure and protected, whether it's at the local level with communities or as national level, or even at a world level to provide world stability, that are rapidly being overcome by these rapid changes in technology that we just never foresaw being used for purposes that were less than good. There's also been conversation about the internet. Is it having unintended consequences in terms of creating echo chambers in terms of what people think? And I think to that answer, I would actually say it's not so much the technology, it's us as humans. My background when I was an undergrad was both computer science and biology. And I partly did biology because I wanted to understand, in some respects, and I say this kind of cheekily, how did evolution and selection pressures end up programming us? Now, I say that because there's no intentionality to it, in my opinion. Evolution is a blind watchmaker, but the environment has selected for certain traits in humans. And part of that is we do like to identify the in and the out group. We like to do the us versus them. And in fact, there's wonderful experiments where you can take teams that have worked together for 10 or 15 years and bonded well, and you randomly give them red beads versus blue beads and put them in a different room for just 20 minutes. And then you say, okay, I'm going to give you each $20. You can keep it. You can wager part of it or all. Whichever team wages the most collectively will get double their money back. The other team won't get anything. And if there's a tie, nobody gets anything at all. And just in that 20 minutes of red versus blue, they'll each start convincing themselves they're going to be more aggressive. They're going to be more decisive than the other team. And they both wager everything. Of course, nobody wins. And so I raise that because there are behaviors that are part of our psyche as human beings that when we encounter this collective technology that brings us together in ways that's never happened before, they lead to interesting side effects that are not necessarily productive, especially for open representative governments. I think if you go back to 1788, James Madison in 1788 in Federalist Papers number 51 said he wanted ambition to counter ambition. He wanted checks and balances. I mean, he wanted people to have turf battles. And that was a way of preventing a king because they had actually had a war against a king. The challenge is, what happens when you're now in an era of 24/7 news? Some of that news might have incentives to just basically get ad clicks versus actually dive deeper. It's not the fault of the news. We are rewarding it because we want to read those articles that are polarizing that say X happened or scandal happened or how dare this ever occur. We don't want to read the one that says it's complicated, it's messy, and give us a more balanced picture. Mm-hmm. And so for me, the people-centered internet, what makes it, as you said, so appropriate is the people-centered start. However, it's also recognizing that a lot of the fixes will come when we decide to change our own actions on the internet.
Very interesting points, David. In your announcement of having joined the people-centered internet, you mentioned a number of questions you were hoping to develop answers for. A couple of examples are, how will we help connect the rest of the world to the internet, as you've talked about? How can we help those who are connected have tools that help them build benevolent and beneficial communities using the internet? Some others among them as well. These are big questions to wrestle with, and a relatively new organization, relatively small, at least in its current iteration. How do you focus your attention and the organization's attention on some things versus other? How do you prioritize?
Absolutely. And you hit the nail on the head that it is all an effort in prioritization. We are sort of a scrappy nonprofit startup, for-benefit startup. So as I mentioned, there's a board. The board includes Vint Cerf as chair. Vint is very much the practical engineer that likes to have proof points along the way. He wants to make sure it's going to work, and I definitely understand and respect that. The other counterpart is Mei-Lin Fung, the mother of customer relationship management. She is a ball of energy. She is a connector. She knows just about everybody. I mean, it's amazing. Like, if you just hang out with Mei-Lin for like 2 hours, you're guaranteed to run into at least five people she knows. that said, Mei Lin's a visionary that is leaping ahead 3 or 4 steps ahead. And so I sometimes feel like my job is to be the middle between the left brain and the right brain, which is let's have some proof points, but also have vision. And I usually, what I try to do is apply the rule of three, which is we can only right now focus on three things well. And so right now, those three things we're trying to do is, first and foremost, we're hopefully going to play a role with Puerto Rico with the reconstruction efforts. Vint is very passionate about that. He and I both share the vision, as does Mei Lin, that if we're going to help them rebuild, we'd like to make sure it's done better. It's more resilient. Because it's not like there's not going to be more hurricanes. There will be. And so this is an area that plays well into people-centered internet sweet spot with its board. We have people that can provide expertise and support on everything ranging from wireless, wired communications. There's also recognition that if you don't have power, communications all for naught. So what can do to make the power more and electricity more resilient? And then think about how it can be used for healthcare and how it can be used for education. And fortunately, we've also had some volunteers that are actually are first-generation Puerto Ricans. A lot of them actually are coming from the military veterans community. So it's not known. The highest ratio of military veterans actually comes from Puerto Rico for the U.S. military. And so they have already made trips there on behalf of People's Internet. They've been on the ground. They've interacted with people. They provided reports back about what's needed. And so, again, espousing the People's Internet's principles, we don't want it to be that some board on high is ordaining what the best thing is. That would be absolutely the wrong way to do it. What we really want to do is listening to people in the community, listening to what they need. What can we do to empower them to make informed choices? Have people they can call on if they want to phone a friend, so to speak. At the end of the day, though, it really is Doug Engelbart's vision of can they actually figure out for themselves how to use it. And you may have different answers. San Juan may have different answers for itself as a city more than the rural areas have. And we want to respect that. So that's the first thing we want to do. The second and the second and third things we want to do, we have been helping with the wildfires in California. And that's an interesting question of how do you restore your identity if you've lost your identity documents? A lot of cases, people lost their social security cards, they lost their birth certificates. I mean, they only had, in some cases, 5 minutes to leave their house. And so, on average, it takes 4 to 5 years to restore these things. And so we've been working with local governments as well as tech companies to figure out a faster way to, one, reestablish and reassert their identity, and at the same time, two, make sure it's not fraud, because they also open it. And that effort, I think, has been successful. We're still going to track it, and we're sure there's going to be other efforts to continue to address the issue of identity, because there is some massive questions, which is, how do you affirm your identity to a government agency online? Mm-hmm. And then third, the last thing we want to ask is, what can we actually do to help with Native Americans? So another effort that Vint and I are very passionate about is Native Americans have unfortunately not had the same opportunity to use the internet to figure out how it can be used in our communities in the United States. And these are definitely sovereign nations of a sort. And so it's also both honoring and respecting that they may have different answers for different Native American tribes. They also may have concerns about, is it going to impact how they're delivering education? Is it going to impact how they retain their youth culture and retain people in the community? And so it is both a technical challenge, but I would say that's only really about 25 or 30%. The other 70% is, how do you empower the community to make informed choices about how they bring the internet in? And then this can ideally scale overseas. So I mentioned all efforts that are right now currently in the U.S. We are talking to different governments in India and Europe, in Africa as well, because there is still the need to bring another 3.4 or so billion people online. And similarly to what I mentioned about the Native Americans, which is there's going to be different answers for different communities, and you have to respect that. And at the same time, you also have to recognize that they may have questions about how is this going to either stabilize or destabilize their current society. How is it going to, you know, either increase the opportunities to work or take challenges to work? Because now they're part of the global ecosystem as a whole. And so by focusing on those three things, they're sort of like the proof points we want to do. And it allows us to focus and channel what we're bringing to bear with the board, with the volunteers. We are, as I mentioned, a nonprofit and a for-benefit combined into one. So if there are opportunities to work with tech companies that actually want to sort of pilot and show the way, we're definitely receptive to that. As mentioned, we're hoping that maybe now that a budget has been passed with the U.S. government for the federal government, we might be able to actually help them, too, with coordinating where the money goes if they have need. But that's up to them. And then at the long term, the vision is, how can we provide guidance and opportunity that actually allows this to be a grassroots effort? Because I'm a big believer that for this to thrive, it's got to be empowering around the world and recognizing that different parts of the world are going to have different answers. I'm a big believer in plurality. And so my job is to sort of be that one that listens to everybody and then tries to figure out what the common language is that's being said by everyone.
You've started to talk a little bit about the way in which you think about, my word, building an ecosystem. You talked about finding technology partners, for example. Given the ambitious goals that you have, the ambitious mission of the people-centered internet, how do you think about the kind of group that you need to assemble in order to accomplish what you're doing? I assume that there's governmental aspects, private sector aspects, international bodies, et cetera.
So this the opportunity to be with People's Internet, actually, they say that you understand your life in reverse, and I feel like that's definitely the case here. So back in 2000, I joined a little-known program called the Bioterrorism Preparedness Response Program and was involved with response to 9/11 and anthrax and other events. But after about 5 years of that, I came to the conclusion I was seeing what I would call lessons incurred but not lessons learned, that we still had challenges grappling at scale for sudden emergent events. It seemed like we were, even though we had guidebooks and playbooks, it seemed like we were just rewriting them every time and we weren't sort of learning lessons. And so my boss at the time said, you can either get a rank of admiral, general, MD, or you can get a PhD, or wait 20 years. And to have enough influence. And I was like, well, what's the easiest? Okay, I guess I'll go get a PhD. So I went to go get a PhD, specifically looking at how do you organize the human and technology elements of an organization to respond to disruptive events. And it was interesting because schools of engineering at the time, this was 2005, said that's great, but we don't care about the people side. Schools of public policy said that's great, but we don't care about the technology side. I was like, well, they kind of need to go together. So ultimately, it was actually in a business school. And it was the Emory was at a business school. And it was nice because it's right next to CDC, so I could use data from the CDC quite easily to do my dissertation. And what I actually showed at the time, so back in 2005, you have to remember, conventional thought was, if you're a manager, you're top down. You give guidance to your reports, you give them structure, you make sure they're all doing the same thing or what you want them to do, you point in the right direction, and you tell them what to do. And I was like, that doesn't seem to work well in dynamic crisis or even just changing events, because the reality is there's many more reports than there is that one manager. And expect the manager to have all the answers is probably a little foolhardy. But if you can empower the reports to actually sort of give signals, and in some respects, you almost invert the pyramid so that the people on the edge are actually empowered to let you know what they're seeing, what's needed. And then there's conversations, and you're just serving as the aggregator and maybe even the facilitator that says, oh, what can I do to help you? What can I do to help you? So in some respects, it's an offshoot of servant leadership, which says the best leaders actually say, what can I do to help, as opposed to follow me. And then two, really, it came to basically three principles that I'm applying to People-Centered Internet. The first is diversity. I mean, it's been shown, now it seems to be much more compelling, but back in 2005, the argument I was making, and other people have later showed too, is a diverse group will outperform a group of experts. And that's been shown. Scott Page has shown that, Tom Malone and Anita Woolsey in academia have shown that actually a combination of experts plus naive participants is better than experts alone, because we all have blind spots. And really what expertise is getting really good at seeing the world a certain way. Frank Lloyd Wright, an amazing architect, but his buildings are falling apart. So we intentionally, when I look at the board, when I look at the volunteers, I'm always asking, who should be a part of this conversation that's not here? And then I try to find ways to bring them in. And usually it's an easy call to mainline or event, and they have connections. I have my own network as well, and so we pull them all in. And in fact, I think that's probably why they wanted me to be executive director, is for just about any situation, I can probably find a positive change agent that's willing to. And that gets the definition of the second thing I try to do, which is empowering the edge. So positive change agents, in my definition, are people at the edge of whatever's going on. They see the fires, or they see the crises that's occurring, or they see the need, and they feel like they want to do something about it. So they're running towards it as opposed to running away from it. They don't assume that their job is just a job description and they operate in the box. They're willing to step outside that. And there's some risk. I mean, when you step outside of expectations, you may not have top cover. Or you may be having someone else that wants you to get back in your box because they see that you're getting on their turf as opposed to whatever they want. And so positive change agents are willing to manage the friction of doing that. And so part of my goal is to find people on the edge and then help them if they are hitting their heads against the wall, or if they've tried several things and they're not making success. How can I help them find a way to navigate through that sort of thorny maze? And it's something I've definitely done myself too. And then finally, the third thing is, as you mentioned, an ecosystem approach. You don't tell ants where to go. You'll never succeed at that. However, basically what I showed was through a combination of how you structure your incentives, how you structure the normative values that you espouse, and how do you work to increase trust levels. Interesting enough, all those things are antecedent to the outcomes that you want. You can change processes however you want. You can change how the business is operating. But in some respects, incentives, values, and trust are antecedent to all of that. And if any one of those is negative, You can have all the best business design processes in the world. You won't get the outcome you want. What's even more interesting, though, and this is sort of counterintuitive, how you change the structure of the organization or how you change the technology that's used in the organization, that's even more antecedent to the incentive. And that seems kind of odd. You're like, well, wait, if I'm offering you $50, why should how I use technology or structure the situation change the value on that $50? But what it shows is if I show you something as a collective action problem and I show you all the faces of everyone else that's participating, you're probably going to be more generous in that $50 than if it's anonymous and you don't see their faces. And so that's just one mini example of how you structure the use of technology can change that perceived value of what you do with the incentives you have or the value you have. And it's basically what we're trying to do with people-centered internet.
That's excellent. I'm curious also, what are the advantages of having grown in the government? You know, so many startups are started by people who are in the private sector. Maybe this is their second or third startup. Maybe they're the only experience they have is in the private sector. You have, although you're not an old man as yet, you have a lot of experience in the government sector. You've got a lot of experience as a chief information officer. I'm wondering what the combination of those as your background actually provide as an advantage from your perspective.
Sure. So I would say the value of government is twofold. First, how to thrive in resource-constrained environments, which I think is essential. And actually, it's interesting. I've actually done 1.5, because the other one was not exactly a startup. It was already sort of at the 30-person stage. But I've done 1.5 organizations that were private sector startups. And the first one, I think, was not aware of what to do with resource constraint because they had accepted outside money. And in some respects, that can lead to challenges. The other one actually had not accepted venture capital. And actually, to their benefit, it allowed them to be more in charge of charting their fate. But they also had to recognize they couldn't do everything, and so you had to prioritize. And so I think the first thing that government actually helps you do when you're trying to do a startup is you know how to actually make sense of resource constraints if you're not going the accept outside money at the very start. Second, how to navigate multiple constituencies. You know, when you're a startup in the private sector, you can focus on one market segment and say, that's what I'm focusing on, and everybody else, sorry. That wouldn't really work for people's internet. That would kind of be a bad approach. And so I look at my career, as I mentioned, with the CDC back in 2000, I was a big advocate of Agile, because the Agile Manifesto had come out in March of 2001. And it was interesting, because I was being told, no, get back in your box, follow the 5-year waterfall plan, do the 3-year enterprise architecture, which, you know, you can fast forward, it still sounds like 2017 in a lot of places. but it was interesting, because I was probably on the way out. I told myself, you know, if I didn't make headway, I was going to probably leave in about 6 or 9 months. But then, of course, 9/11 happened, and immediately it was in, like, how come you didn't do more? And I was like, well, because we were trying to do Agile, but you were trying to force us on a 5-year plan, and everything like that. So that taught me that you do have to stick to your guns, but you also have to listen in some respects. And so it's that balance of how do I know I'm right, or how do I know if I'm on the right path, but not get arrogant enough that I'm now just creating breaking glass. I would also fast forward to another role I had. So two other roles. One was when I was in Afghanistan. I was actually traveling on Department of Defense travel orders as a civilian, but I was assigned to initially NATO forces, and then they were actually standing up U.S. forces in Afghanistan. This was 2009. And it was literally 2 days after the inauguration of the administration at the time. And that was interesting because you're talking to, of course, all the services, but it's not just U.S. forces. There were folks from UK, Germany, Australia, and then talking to local Afghans and also NGOs, trying to identify problems you didn't know were problems yet, and then even more, come up with solutions. Because, you know, it does no good to go to general and say, you've got a problem over here. It's like, here's what you might be able to do about it. And fortunately, I think I had about almost 60% batting average on both identifying things that were not working, but then also recommending strategies and actually getting them to make a change. There were some times, though, where I'd actually go up to some foreign office for another country and they would eventually say, you know, you're right. However, it looks good to be doing X, and so we're going to still pursue X, even though you've recommended Y. And so at a certain point in time, you have to say, okay, I've done my bid. And so I think that applies to people's internet, which is, it is a scrappy nonprofit for-benefit startup. At the same time, we are trying to bring together constituencies that have different goals. And there are some things that are lightning rods that if I phrase them a certain way, will just antagonize people. If, however, I come in with a question and I actually speak a more common language that brings the different groups together, it'll make all the difference and actually help them work together.
That's great. This is not the only thing you're doing these days. Among the portfolio of activities is you are a 2018 Marshall Fellow. And I wonder if you could take a moment to talk about that experience, and especially that experience in 2018, in light of, you know, speaking of the U.S. government,
yes.
decisions made there that make the Marshall Plan call into question the nature of the Marshall Plan, et cetera.
Right. So it is 70 years after the Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan was actually, it was April 70 years ago that Congress had passed and then the President Truman at the time signed the Marshall Plan. And you have to remember, I mean, World War II had happened. Europe, unfortunately, was pretty much needing to be rebuilt. There's some debate as to how much impact the Marshall Plan had in terms of actual rebuilding. However, I think it was a very visible sign in which the U.S. saw the need to actually recognize that after a war, you don't just walk away from it, that you actually needed to actually recognize that we all ties rise together. And so with the Marshall Fellowship, what I'm going to is I'm looking at how in just the last 10 years, there's been a dramatic rise in, one, preferences of direct democracy over representative democracy in both Europe and the United States. And so that's an interesting phenomenon, populism of sorts. There's good and bad with it. Now people feel like they have more of a voice, but I think the reason why you see that, unfortunately, is an increasing skepticism in trusting representative government to do its work. And to me, that's troublesome because while I do want to hear from the public what they want, how many of us have time to get informed on issues, say, like vaccination policy or what to do about fish and wildlife? I mean, that's a niche subject that does require some degree of expertise. That said, maybe there's a way we can upgrade representative governments to engage in this future. There's also been a rise in what's called subnationalism. And so you're seeing countries now engage directly where a country is engaging directly with a city or a state and bypassing the larger U.S. government. That raises interesting questions of the Treaty of Westphalia and, like, sovereignty. And so that's an interesting question as well. GDPR, General Data Protection Regulation, is going to go into effect starting in May. And that raises interesting questions because it does put a very strong impetus on protecting privacy. But there's still some things that are unclear, which is an IP address considered to be personally identifiable information? Right now, Europe would say yes. So if you share an IP address without consent of the owner, in quotation marks, of that IP address, you are in violation of GDPR and potentially could be fined up to 4% of your revenue. So what do you do if all you're trying to do is monitor fraud or have defense against something going wrong? There's some interesting questions there. And then lastly, of course, concerns about rising misinformation, things on the internet. The neighbor, as I say, the neighbor to the east for both the U.S. is a big question as well. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to be basically going to six different countries and just trying to basically synthesize their views as to what should be done about the future of the transatlantic relationship. I personally think it does need to be upgraded. Again, I mentioned I was in Afghanistan in 2009. And I will say I saw some countries pulling more of their weight than others, and that included some European countries. And so it was varied in terms of which ones were pulling more of their weight. And if it really is a collective defense treaty that we think about with NATO, we probably need to think about how do we make sure and assure that it is a collective action. It's not just some that are free riding off the rides of others. Also, it's to recognize that we may be at a very interesting crossroads for representative governments, representative democracies, republics as a whole. And I would include even constitutional monarchies like UK, which are constitutional monarchy only in name, but they have a parliamentary system. The challenge is we're open societies from the beginning. And if there's any trend that the internet is doing, that biology is doing, the Internet of Things are doing, is that it's super empowering people to do things that are unprecedented as a species. You have more computing power, according to some, than President Reagan had in 1981.
In your mobile phone.
In your mobile phone, exactly. Yeah. And that's just your mobile phone. Yeah.
Compared to all he had in the government, exactly. Right.
And then you also think about how many of us could have asked a question of a device in our house and got an answer near instantaneously just 10 or 15 years ago. I mean, this is unprecedented, super empowering. The same thing is happening with drones, with bio. In some respects, it's going to be great, personalized medicine. But we need to recognize that the future of the next 10 to 15 years is going to be personalized medicine. Personalized medicine is also personalized poison. And so this is going to strain how we do security, how we do stability. And I don't think the answer is to become autocracies. But I do worry that autocracies will be able to outperform representative governments because they can make unilateral decisions at a speed that our deliberative processes can't match. Mm. And so the question is, how do we adapt to this era? And I don't think it's isolationism. I don't think it's closing down the borders. I don't think it's also, I mean, I think right now there's been some mixed messages over the 5 years, if I can be honest, in which in some respects technology and or space became almost the end of itself as opposed to means. And I think that was challenging, which is if you only focus on tech or space, you're going to miss the broader people dimension. And so in some respects, we as the U.S. And Europe, too, to a degree, are at a crossroads where we have not set the stage for what does the next 30 years, what do we want it to look like? And if we abdicate that and we step back, I'm worried we may not be happy with the future that eventually unfolds.
Very interesting. It won't be surprising for people who hear you speak and know that you have a PhD and are quoting from the Federalist Papers and a variety of academics that you have academic inclinations yourself. You have lectured at Harvard, at Oxford. You have an affiliation now with Singularity University. Mm-hmm. And would love to just understand your perspectives on why you continue to return to the ivory tower, so to speak, in various different forms. Yep. How you've engaged the academic community.
Sure. The story of how I got a PhD was simply because I was hitting my head against a wall at the CDC. It was interesting because two things happened while I was getting my PhD, and then I'll tell a little bit more about academia. So while I was there, there was this thing called Social Science Research Network, or SSRN, that came out, which was on the internet that would allow you to put your draft papers and published papers online for anyone to access. And at the time, the model of academia, and it still is to a large degree, is you submit your paper to a journal, only that journal sees it. If they approve it, then it eventually gets published, and it's usually behind a paywall. And so my professors and even my dissertation advisor at the time kind of thought I was throwing my life away by putting my work out there. They said, well, someone's going to copy your work, or they're going to get it, I was like, well, my research is on collaboration, so if someone someone sees that they need to do that, then, I need to practice what I preach. What it did lead to, actually, was about a year and a half into it, was private sector as well as government agencies actually found my papers easier because they were available online, and that led to interesting collaborations. And so it did have a second order effect. Now, I did see over time, I would occasionally get asked to review a paper, and I'd be like, this looks very familiar to something I wrote. And yeah, so there's the good and the bad. But that was the first thing that taught to me that maybe academia solely as the way forward might not be the right thing for me, because I was sort of stepping outside of expectations. And then two, I don't know if too many people actually would sign to go up to Afghanistan after they did their dissertation. And so I raised my hand and was willing to do that. And the reason why, academia is definitely a place to help inform big picture thoughts and do strategy. And I love doing that. However, in some respects, I feel like Sherlock Holmes, which is until you actually solve the case, all you've done is postulate as to the possible solution, but you actually have to solve the case. And so I like environments in which I am able to think about strategy and then actually translate into action. And so that's where I probably sort of why I like, the best work, in my opinion, is where I'm doing both at the same time, which is what I'm doing right now. And so with Singularity and with Harvard and with Oxford, they have all been opportunities to have conversations about the future. And what's interesting is I'm hearing from more and more from the private sector. I give presentations, whether it's on biosecurity, cyber resiliency, even though those are very technical subjects, they all lead to, so what does this mean for the next 10 years for the U.S., which is in some respects a governance question. And I'm not saying governance meaning it's going to be solved by government. In fact, if anything, I think it's going to be solved by something wholly new that straddles between the private sector and the public sector in ways we've not imagined. I don't pretend to have all the answers. However, I'd like to be able to raise the questions in a forum that has, again, those diverse participants so we can try and figure it out, because it does need to occur. I think the challenge we've got is, can we come up with the answers fast enough? Because the world is moving headlong to a future that it's unclear if it's going to be better or worse. Again, having adopted a newborn baby boy, I do think about what is 2030. And there was actually a presentation I gave, I think it was around 2003, 2004, and then I actually did a repeat presentation about 2.5 years ago to the National Intelligence Council that actually said, I'm not sure if the idea of organizing geographically by nation states exists past 2030. And the reason why is, one, where's a packet of information on the internet? Is it where it's sent from or is it received by? And if you try to apply laws by geography, you're going to have some challenges. Two, though, infectious diseases don't stop at borders. And so, we are increasingly, the good news is we're increasingly more connected than ever, and that's a good thing. The bad news is we are now increasingly more connected than everything. And so to me, the reason why I continue to press forward, the common theme amongst all of this is, if I was to look back, I'd like to have played a role in helping shape that future of whatever the transition is to something new, and hopefully making it not a violent one, hopefully making it one that's equitable as possible to everyone, and recognizing, though, that this is happening. It's almost like we're compressing 100 years of the Industrial Revolution into 10 years, and we're all distracted from things that, unfortunately, in my opinion, a lot of the things don't really matter, opposed to the deeper substance we need to address to, and we're not asking the deeper questions, which is, how do we want to coexist? How do we want to live? And so I'm hopeful that through the Marshall Fellowship, through People's Internet, and through Singularity in Harvard, we might eventually begin to actually have conversations around the United States, and maybe outside the United States too, although I'm biased because I'm a U.S. citizen, where we begin to get from all sides, not just the East Coast, not just the Heartland, but get all sides saying, how do we want to coexist in an era in which this rapid change is occurring? And it's not just a job question. It's not just a technology question. It really is, what do we want the future to be for our children?
Well, we will stay tuned. And thank you for the good work that you're doing, David. David Bray, thank you for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT. As always, a great conversation.
Thanks for having me, Peter. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please rate us on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please join me next week when my guest will be Vince Campisi, the Senior Vice President of Digital and Chief Information Officer of United Technologies.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy-setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.